You know what? I'm going to do verse 2. I know that's going to throw you all off. So you have to go all the way back. You can use in that. That one's... Oh, yeah. We're going to do that, but we're also going to start with verse 2. Thanks for reminding me.
Are you going to review 2? Is that what's happening?
Yeah, I'm going to review 2 and then go on. But it's just that it's so many pages. That's all. Chapter 13, verse 2.
4:10.
Om Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Krantitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashatyayinim Ambatvam Anusantatami Bhagavad Gita Bhagavad Varshinim. We'll start chanting from verse 1, and then we'll do 2, and 4, 2 again. Om Shri Bhagavan Uvacha Idam Shariram Kaunteya Idam Shariram Kaunteya Kshetram Ityabhidhiyate Kshetram Ityabhidhiyate Etad Yovetitam Prahuhu Etad yovetitam prahuhu kshetrajna iti tadvidaha kshetrajna iti tadvidaha kshetrajnam chapi mam vidhi kshetrajnam chapi mam vidhi sarva kshetreshu bharata sarva kshetreshu bharata kshetra kshetrajna yor jnanam Kshetra kshetra jnayor jnanam Yattad jnanam matam mama Yattad jnanam matam mama. So, in the first verse, having said to Count Hey Kaunteya, Hey son of Kunti, Kunti was Arjuna's mother, he says, Idam shariram, this body. And this body also accounts for the subtle body also. So this body, says idam shariram, kshetram. This body is the kshetra. Kshetra means field. This body is the field of experience. We went over different meanings of kshetram last time. So this body is the field of experience. It is called the kshetra. Etad yahaveti tam prahuhu kshetrajnaha tadvidha. Those who know, those who have viveka, really, those tadvidaha, those who know, they say that the one who knows this body, veti, the one who knows this body, that one is the kshetrajnaha. Okay? That one is the kshetrajnaha, the knower of the field. So the viveka has to take place here now between the field of experience and the knower of the field of experience. Initially, that there need be such a viveka isn't even, one doesn't even think about it. I'm the kshetrajna, everything else is the kshetra. I'm the knower of the field, everything I know is the field, right? But I stop right here at idam shariram, this body. Okay? So in the next verse, the Mahavakya comes in right away. So Krishna says in the next verse, so he goes, kshetrajnam cha Api mam vidhi. He says, and may you know the kshetrajna, the knower of the field, to be me, Krishna, to be Ishvara, means to be the Atma, the Brahman, to be Brahman. Because he says, to be me, sarva kshetreshu he bharata, may you know me to be the knower of the field who is in all beings, sarva bhuteshu, may you know me as the one who is, as the knower of the field, who is in all beings. There's the kshetra, I am the kshetrajna, so another way to say this, I am the kshetrajna, who is in all beings. The one who is the Kshetrajna is me, and I am in all beings. Okay? So then he says, Kshetrajnyoho Jnanam. That which is the Jnanam, the knowledge between the Kshetra, the knowledge between, or the knowledge of the Kshetra and the Kshetrajnyaha. The Jnanam of the Kshetra and the Kshetrajnyaha, that, he goes, Matam mama, that in my opinion, Krishna says, according to me, and that in my opinion, that is knowledge. That is the knowledge. That is what is to be known. So, what happens, and this is a Mahavakya, because what happens here is to for you to get from the place of myself, of me being the knower of my experience, to the recognition that the conscious being that I am, that this conscious being that I am, the Pratyagatma, is the self of all beings. That is a jump. So, this, if I am the Kshetrajna, right? I am the Kshetrajna. And if I say that I am the Kshetrajna, now we have to decide what that means, because if I say I am the Kshetrajna, I am not the self in all beings. How do I go from myself as the Kshetrajna, the knower of my experience, to being the self of all beings? Because I am not yourself. How could I be yourself? You know your body, I know my body. I know my mind, I know my sense organs, I know my thoughts, I don't know your thoughts. I don't have your experiences. I don't have your dreams, I don't have your memories. I don't have your experiences. I don't have your relationships. So how can I, well, I'm the Kshetrajna, how can I be you? That's what it amounts to, because Krishna says, know that I am the Kshetrajna, please know me as the Kshetrajna, who is the self in all beings. In all beings, in all the beings, the Kshetrajna is me. And so for that, to understand that, I have to give up an identity with everything that I had taken to be myself. I don't give up myself. I have to give up the identity with all of the things I had identified with as myself and recognize that everything I had identified with as myself actually is the Kshetra. Kshetra means that field of experience. And so that's why one of the primary, in being able to really gain this knowledge, not theoretically as a theory or as a philosophy, but to actually recognize the truth of it, the Vedanta as a pramana is using words to point to your experience, to differentiate your experience in ways that you have probably not differentiated before. You know, we can differentiate, and we have the means of knowledge available to us to differentiate our experience that we gain through our sense perception, right? And also, I can use words to point to experience. Like I could say, please look at the lamp on my left, you know? Or look at the painting of the ocean on my wall. I'm using words to point, to experience. But these pointers are all pointing to things which my sense organs can land on. The Vedanta is not pointing to things in the end that your sense organs can land on, because it is pointing to the Pratyagatma, to your innermost self, which is not objectifiable by the sense organs. Not objectifiable by the mind. The mind can't look at yourself. Because who's the self is there illumining the mind? So, you know, ultimately you are the conscious being, not the mind. The mind is illumined. You're aware of the mind. You're aware of the thoughts. You're aware of the perceptions. You're aware of the emotions. You're even aware of the I thought. I am doing this. I am doing that. I am a conscious being. I am this body. It can be ignorant statements or knowledgeable statements. The ahankara can identify with anything. That's just a thought that you're aware of. anything that you're aware of, anything that can be objectified, that you can describe, that you can talk about, that you can differentiate one thing from the other, within duality, within this world of this world that we perceive and experience, that's the kshetra. The kshetra, the field of experience, can be differentiated one thing from another, but we are not used to differentiating this field of experience from me, the kshetra-jna. Now, once we do that, using the teaching methodology, this prakriya that we call drik drisha viveka, that seer seeing differentiation. Drik means seer, drisha seeing, viveka, the discrimination between the two. This is one of the primary prakriyas. It's one of the first teaching methodologies that we usually use, because everything that's said in the Upanishads is dependent on this viveka. It's dependent upon this kshetra, kshetrajna, differentiation. Now the thing is, when I complete this process of differentiation, what happens to me is that everything, not only are all the objects that I know in the world objectified, but the means of knowledge also are objectified. And once they're objectified, they become kshetra, means I illumine them. If I, the kshetra-jna, illumine this, have a subject-object relationship with this, whatever this is, this becomes the field. So there's a viveka to be made between the conscious being and the known field of experience. And so look at what happens when we've been through this many times, but I'm just going to just take you step by step so you can just experience it. With my sense, these sense organs, these eyes, ears, etc., these become the kshetra-jna to the five sense objects. My eyes see form, my ears hear sound, etc., my sense of touch, feel, my sense of smell, my sense of taste. You know, so the five sense organs allow me to experience this kshetra, this field. And from the standpoint of this field that's being experienced, the sense organs become the knower of the field, right? So that's a viveka. Viveka means I recognize that I, the sense organs, are different, separate, objectifying the field. So I have a subject-object relationship. That's the viveka. There's a subject-object relationship, and I can become aware of my sense organs versus the objects that the sense organs objectify. Everybody see? Kshetra-jna, kshetra. But then we have to move in a step where I realize that, well, wait a minute. The five sense organs themselves are objectified by the mind. Because I know if the five sense organs are working, I know if I'm blind or if I'm going deaf or if I've lost my sense of touch or my sense of smell, I'm aware of these five sense organs. And then you have to notice, is that true? And you just become aware of your eyes. Are your eyes as good as they were 20 years ago? Probably not. How's your hearing? Do you still have your sense of touch? Say, yes, I do, thank goodness. Okay, so you can your mind is aware. It can check up on, it can objectify your five sense organs. Once you say that, the five sense organs now join the field. They now become part of the kshetra because they can be objectified, and the kshetra-jna moves in a notch. The kshetra-jna is now the mind. But then we have to say, well, the mind, are you aware of your thoughts? Are you aware of your perceptions? Yes. Are you aware of your feelings? Yes. Can you watch your thought flow? Yes. Can you tell me what you just thought? Yes. Can you tell me what you're feeling? Yes. Are you always feeling that? No, only sometimes. Are you always looking at that painting? No, very rarely. Okay. So you're aware. You're aware of all of the thought flow, all of the moods, all of the emotions. Are you aware of your imaginations? Yes. Are you aware of your dreams? Yes. Kshetra. Mind is now given over to the kshetra because it is known. And you're watching thought after thought, feeling after feeling, feeling after feeling. And so now the kshetra-jna becomes the conscious being that is illumining this mind. And you say, well, is that conscious being is me? Does that mean it's the I thought? It's I. If I say I, is that it? Is that me? I. Well, actually, you're not walking around saying I. I is just a thought. Like, say you see the painting. You have a vritti, a thought modification of the painting. Then you say, oh, I'm looking at the painting. Is that I a thought that labels you, or is it you? If the ahankara, if the I was you, the thought was you, it would have to always be there, and it's not. So it's a vritti, it's just a thought. Now, you can say all of your knowledges, all of the things that you've learned, is that you? Well, no, those are my memories and my knowledge. But I'm not carrying that around with me all of the time. Otherwise, it would be a very heavy burden. You know, it would be like walking in one of those rooms. Have you ever seen those rooms, especially with some of these scholars who, their room is just, it's piled with books everywhere, mm-hmm. and papers. And they carve out, one friend was telling me about this, and they carve out little areas, because that's how your mind would be. If that was you. That's not so. You're always fresh, actually. But now look what's happening, though, as we do this, go interior, in a sense, differentiate me from these experiences at subtler and subtler levels. What happens if you take away, just hypothetically, or just even recognizing it by through this viveka discrimination inside of you, internally, in your experience, you drop off from you these things that you're aware of that are coming and going in your experience. If you take them away, now let's say for all of us, let's take away the physical world from me. That doesn't belong to me. Take away the physical world that you're aware of with your sense organs. And then, well, let's take away the sense organs too, because they're also objectified. They also don't belong to you because they're objectified. Now you've taken away, if you take away the sense organs, you're also taking away knowership. The knowership that the sense organs provide. Now, since the sense organs are illumined by the mind, and the mind is illumined by you, right? So here this mind that illumines the sense organs will take away those sense organs. We have the mind then. But the mind is also illumined, is known. Right? Is coming and going within me. I'm the stable one. The mind is coming and going. So now, that all goes to the kshetra. But now I've removed another level of knowership. I've removed the thinker, the enjoyer, the seer, the hearer. All means of knowledge are gone. And so now, what is left? Even the I thought I remove. All of my knowledge, all my relationships, all of these things, even my ignorance, I can say, I don't know this and I don't know that. Well, I'm aware of that too. That's illumined. So what if I take away the kshetra? What is left is just what? Me. The very nature of the kshetra, kshetra-gnya, minus all of these objectified experiences. And the kshetra-gnya then, the conscious being me, is it performing? Is it knowing? Is it thinking? Is it enjoying? Oh, that was such a nice soup I had. You know? Is it thinking, analyzing, experience? With what? The mind is thinking, analyzing. The mind is feeling. It's doing all of these. The mind is suffering and enjoying, and hurting, and having fun, all kinds of emotions. You know? It's making discernments, I like this, I don't like that. I'm happy, I'm sad. These are all things that are going on in the mind. So if I say, now look at this, I am happy, I am sad, these are the verses that are coming up, so I'm not going to get too much into them right now. But these states of mind belong to the mind. If I remove the state of mind, or I remove the mental experience or the perceptual experience from me, from my own swarupa, from my own nature, am I doing anything? I don't lose my consciousness. I am always a conscious being. I can't get away from consciousness. But when I remove the kshetra from consciousness, is the consciousness doing anything? Am I doing anything? Now, this can sound maybe abstract. I don't really want it to be abstract. I want it to land on you. And so what I would say, you know, when we did the meditation, when you're just sitting as yourself and, you know, like kind of bringing your mind back just to recognize you, this very personal me, even in this moment, you can recognize your own presence. And in meditation, you can it just makes things easier. You can just bring your own self to the forefront. Not your thoughts, the one who's present to the thoughts. Not the emotions, not the perceptions. All of those things are wafting through, all of the imaginations, the memories, whatever is happening when you're just sitting quietly, whatever is going on. Those things can all go on, but you just let the mind come back to the one who is present to all of that. The one who is present to all of that is there present when all of that's going on. It's not that you're not present. You are. It's not that you're even hidden by them in any way. But the mind you can keep just bringing back, like breathing. Just noticing yourself, taking a bath in your own presence, like breathing. Your mind just gets used to doing it. Swamiji, remember, I've used this example so many, told the story of Swamiji so many times. When somebody asked, do you meditate, Swamiji? Do you meditate? And he thought, well, I meditate between thoughts. You meditate between thoughts. If you're at, when all he means by that, yourself, you, are present always. And self-evident also, always. But your mind is busy doing this and that. It doesn't hide you at all. The viveka is still there, but your mind is busy doing this and that and this and that. But whenever it has a little time out, then it just comes home. It's coming home. It's coming home. It's coming home just naturally. Those are little samadhis. It is like a little samadhi, you know? So think about this. And I say that very literally. Your mind enjoys your own being. The me is the self of every thought that you have. So the thought, the mind is going on thinking or being engaged in the world as it is. And so this Satikalpa, this creation, Ishwara, is the Namarupa, that's always filling the thoughts. So it's your being with the Namarupa, with these names and forms. And then your mind can just take a little breather all of the time, just enjoying yourself for a moment. Just recognizing, reveling in yourself, even for a split second. Just being with yourself. It's with yourself now. And your sense organs are open. Yourself hasn't gone anywhere. You're still you. But the mind enjoys, as so often throughout the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna will say, the mind just revels in the self. It revels in the self because your nature is fullness, is ananda. Not a bliss state, but just the wholeness of me, your own simple presence. And so the mind keeps checking in, keeps coming back, just like breathing. It's very, very natural. Okay, so now, what Bhagavan says here, I am the kshetrajna, right, in all beings. How can it be that this me really is the self in all beings? If Krishna says, I am the self in all beings, he's talking about himself, the Paramatma, the conscious being. He's not talking about an upadhi, because Bhagavan Ishwara also is not an upadhi. Ishwara says, you know, I am this creation, and not saying, not realizing that I am the self of all of this, then Bhagavan would be ignorant. So when Krishna is talking about this, that himself here, he's talking about himself as the Atma, as the Paramatma, as Brahman, as Satchidananda. That's what he's talking about. And that Satchidananda that I am, as the Kshetrajna, is the Satchidananda, the conscious being, that you are, that you are, that you are, that all beings are, that Krishna is, that Ishwara is, that the table is, in fact. And that can be the reason that that is, and that that is even a possibility, is because all of the things that make, that differentiate us, me from you, or me from Ishwara, anything that might differentiate us, is the Kshetra. Goes into the realm of the Kshetra, not the Kshetrajna. What that means is that the knowership goes into that realm. Not the consciousness, but the consciousness of something. Conscious being is different than conscious being of something. And so, see, look at it like this. I'm different from you because my body is different from your body, which is a fact. This body is different from this body. So, if the Kshetrajna belongs to the bodies, then there's no one. There's no one there. There's many. If the Kshetrajna belongs to the sense organs, there's not one there. There's many. My sense organs, nobody's going to be able to tell me that my sense organs are your sense organs. So there's not one there. There's many. If the Kshetrajna belongs to the mind, then my mind and my thoughts are not your mind and your thoughts. You can definitely differentiate. Then there would be many. What I am knowing at this moment is different than what you're knowing at this moment. We're not having the same vrittis. We're not having the same experiences. We're going to be different. So, if talking on that level, there's duality, and there's difference between us. Even the ahankara, when you're having an I thought, I'm not having an I thought. What if when I had an I thought, you all had to have an I thought? If I think I, then you must think I, because I is the kshetra, again, I'm thinking, so therefore. It's not so. That is kshetra. That's the field. That is objectified. So all the knowledges are like that, all our ignorance is like that, anything objectified is like that, differentiates us. But when we get to me, the conscious being, which is differentiated from the mind, and the I thought, and the sense organs, and the body, and all of the objectified experiences, what at that level differentiates me from you? Because consciousness needs a mind to be thinking, and it needs sense organs to be seeing. But these things all belong to the dream, in a sense. They all belong to the field. So now, my being, what makes me different from you? Well, not the body, not the sense organs, not the mind, not the moods, not the emotions, not the thoughts, not the I thought, not the knowledges, not the ignorances, not the relationships. You said, well, space. Space, because here I'm a little bubble of conscious being, and you're over there a little bubble of conscious being, and you're over there a little bubble of conscious being. So there's space between us. You get rid of all of the bodies, but now there's this little bubbles of conscious being located in different spots. So, but is space objectified? Is space known to you? What about in deep sleep? There is no space. What if you close your eyes? The room space is gone. Space is also known. And so space isn't dividing us. Space is part of the field. In fact, space, air, fire, water, earth, all of the five elements are part of the kshetra. That's what we'll be seeing in a minute. And so, what is between conscious being and conscious being? It can't be something that is objectified. So what is the dividing line? Anything that can be a dividing line is objectified. Consciousness itself, me, the conscious being, isn't objectified. I can have consciousness, look at the consciousness over here. Here I am, conscious being, let me look at it. Well, first of all, I need not look, I can't look at it. I can't objectify it, and I need not objectify me, because I'm consciousness. And consciousness is its own self-evident experience, not a subject-object experience, it's self-shining, swatha-siddha, swaprakashatvam, self-evident. And so this me that I am is the self in all beings. Same for Ishvara. Ishvara says exactly the same. The self that I am is the self in all beings. For Ishvara also, there's the kshetra and the kshetrajna. The kshetra is the whole maya upadi, the whole manifested creation, and including the avyakta, the unmanifest condition of the creation, as we'll see. This whole creation is kshetra for Ishvara. And so Ishvara will say, I, the paramatma, the satchitananda, the conscious being, the me, this me is the self in all beings. So here in this verse he says, first he says to in the first verse he says to Arjuna, know this body as the kshetra, and know the knower of this body as the kshetrajna. Starts there. And then he says also the reason that Krishna says this body as the kshetra is because you already know all of this is the kshetra. You don't have to tell you that this is the field of experience. You know that. You're the kshetrajna. This is the kshetra. That's where we start. He doesn't have to say, oh, this painting and everything you're aware of is the field. And you know. He says, no, that's true. We all know that's the starting place. But no, this body is the kshetra. And the knower is the kshetrajna. That starts the whole Driksha Viveka. And that ends with the second verse. And he says, and also may you know me as the kshetrajna in all beings. Okay? The one who is the kshetrajna in the end is the Paramatma, is Brahman, is the self of Ishvara. Because Ishvara is going to say the same thing. Right? I am the self. This is the kshetra, the whole universe, the whole maya upadi on every level, as we'll see as we go on now, is the kshetra. I am the kshetrajna. And that kshetrajna, after you remove what is objectifiable, is just conscious being. Conscious being, which is the self of the whole creation. And when you want to recognize that conscious being in yourself, the kshetrajna, these words like conscious being, awareness, are fine, but they have to land on me. When you're sitting there in contemplation, you are there. You. The one that you take to be you, what has to happen is that we have to do a viveka, because what you feel when you say I am just your own presence, the very personal me, your own self. The only problem is that your recognition is perfect. That is you. There's no other you. There's no other kshetrajna, only that. But now we have to take all the dresses off. It's dressed. It's wearing all kinds of dresses. It's wearing the body, which is kshetra. And it's taken itself to be that, you know. From the body standpoint, the body is that. But from your standpoint, you are free of that. Because it's objectified. So that has to, you have to do that differentiation. Okay, here I am. I'm aware of this body, but I'm free. I'm the conscious being, but I'm not even doing anything to know it. I'm abiding there. You have to recognize that. Then you have to look at your sense organs. Okay, I'm aware of these sense organs. That's true. They're kshetra. And then what am I? Then you realize you just let your mind drift back to your own presence, back and forth. And then you realize, I am here. I'm not doing anything. And then look at your mind. You see all of the thoughts. You're aware of them. Differentiate. Let the mind differentiate itself from your own self-evident nature. And then you say, am I doing anything? Am I that mind that's coming and going? Am I those thoughts, emotions coming and going? No. Then you recognize you. You're recognizing you. And then you have to say, your mind has to say something like this. Wow. They mean that I am the conscious being. These words, conscious being, awareful being, all of these words have to have, it's like an awakening, where you have to realize that these words are talking about me. The me that I've always taken to be me, but I have not realized that I am changeless, that I am indestructible, that I can't be objectified, that I'm never not there. That there's no coming and going for me, that I'm always exactly the same. I have to realize all these words that the Upanishads are talking about this simple me that has always been me, has always will be me, and that it is this very me that is Ishvara. It is this very me that's the Paramatma, that is Brahman, that is when Ishvara says, I am the self in all beings, this is who Ishvara is talking about. When Ishvara says, I am the self of all beings. He's talking about me, this self, which is the one self in all beings. And so the pramana, the Vedanta as a pramana, has to work like this. It has to land on your experience because it's pointing to you. So if you're listening to it out here as though it's a lecture or as though it's the Upanishadic philosophy, you know, that's not what it is. It's not a philosophy, it's philosophical, you can say, but that's not what it is. It's a pramana. The Upanishads are a pramana. That means they're a teaching methodology that is between the teacher and the student, where these words have to, you know, have to land on the reality of your own experience, the very personal experience. So that's what these verses are about. And so he says, so Krishna says in this verse too, know me to be the one who's the kshetrajna in all beings. And then he says, in my opinion, you know, this is what knowledge is. This differentiation between the kshetra and the kshetrajna, this understanding, this is knowledge. Okay. So let's go to the next verse. Tatchetram yachaya dripcha, tatchetram yachaya dripcha, yadvikari yatashchayat, yadvikari yatashchayat, sachayo yat prabhavascha, sachayo yat prabhavascha, tatsamasena meshvanu, tatsamasena meshvanu. So he says, that which is, so Bhagavan's still talking. At the end he says, Tetsama Sena Meshvanu. Listen to me here. In brief, what I'm going to tell you in brief. Sama Sena means briefly. I'm going to tell you this briefly. Please listen. Meshvanu. I'm going to tell you that which is the kshetra. The kshetra, the field. Tet kshetram. Yet chayadrik. What it is like, what's its nature? He's going to talk about for a while, what is the kshetra? He's going to talk about what it is, yadrik, what it is like, what is its nature? Yed vikari, and how does it modify? How does it change? Vikari means change. How does it modify? How does it change? And yatas chayat, and from what does it come? From where does it come? How does it come? So what is the kshetra? What is its nature? What modifications does it go through? And from what does it come? That I'm going to tell you. And then, Satcha Yaha Yet Prabhavaha. And who that is. He's talking now about the kshetra, because it's in the masculine, kshetrajna. And who is that kshetrajna? And he says, Yet Prabhavaha. What is its power? What is its shakti? Prabhava means shakti. What is its glory? What is its power? What is the Ishwara shakti? What is its capacity? So these two things, he says, I'm going to tell you that briefly, he says. Just in brief. And he does. He's going to tell it in a couple of verses, actually, but in much more detail later. For this... For this yet prabhavaha, talking about Ishwara, about the kshatrajnaha, what is its prabhava? He says prabhava means upadi kritaha shaktiyaha yasya, whose shakti, whose power, the power, the capacity, you know, the kriya shakti, the power to act, jnana shakti, icha shakti, all of these powers that exist in or capacities. Energy that exists in the whole creation. Those are upadi kritaha. They're shaktis which are born of the upadi. See, Brahman, the kshatrajna, from the standpoint of just satchitananda, awareness, isn't doing anything. Right? And so when we talk about the prabhava, we're talking about the Ishwara shakti, the maya shakti that manifests this whole creation. So, when we're taught the conscious being, we have to get, well, I'll just do a couple of minutes on this. When we're talking about, first of all, the viveka, being able to discriminate, just in your own experience, the differentiation between your own presence, just you, just the simple, very simple presence, which is changeless. So simple, it's not doing anything. There's a viveka that has to take place between that and the kshetra, all of the experiences of the creation that are taking place in the creation that include your body, mind, sense organs, moods, emotions, everything, the whole sphere of experience on every level, even deep sleep, which is a causal condition. So there has to be a viveka, a discrimination between these two. But then you have to, having made that discrimination, that's not enough. Now we have to understand what is the relationship between the kshatrajna and the kshatra? What is that relationship? Is this world of experience something going on by itself? Or does it have its source in the kshatrajna? So this relationship has to be unfolded. And that unfoldment, for those who know, who have been coming to class for a while, is satya mitya, that karya karana, that causal relationship, is really not really causal. It's satya mitya, where this whole kshetra, you know, is dependent for its very being on the kshetrajna, on conscious being. It's a satya mitya relationship. And so now, if you say that, it's a satya mitya relationship. Just a quick example, if I take the clay pot, right, a clay pot, this is used in the Chandogya, clay pot and iron nail cutter. Let's look at clay pot. The satya-mitya relationship, the pot is mitya. It depends totally on the clay. It has no being of its own. So if the relationship between the kshetra, the field, and the kshetrajna, consciousness, is satya-mitya, then this field, the entire universe, right, has no independent being, and therefore it is not separate from the kshetrajna, but at the same time, it's a different order of reality. It can't touch it. It can't change it or do anything to it. Just like your dream, you can have an incredible dream. Lots of things can be happening in the dream, but when you wake up, none of the things that happened in that dream, including the whole dream itself, has any impact or doesn't touch the waking state at all. If you had a big meal in the dream, you still wake up hungry. So that satya mitya relationship is what is there. So here, though we're not unfolding that yet in this chapter, I just want you to understand that when he says, you know, and the kshetrajna, what is that capacity? What is his capacity? The capacity is that maya. The maya itself is not away from conscious being, but it is mitya. And so when we're talking about the prabhava, kind of the glory or the shakti and all of these things, the Ishwara shakti, we're talking about that shakti which is born of the upadi. Upadi means that conditioning agent that we call the whole maya upadi. For the jiva upadi, you have the stula sharira, the sukshma sharira, the physical body, the subtle body, the mind, all of these are upadis. The Ishwara upadi is the whole maya creation, the absolute, you know, infinite manifest knowledge. That's the maya upadi. So that maya is the Ishwara shakti, which has for its truth Brahman, just like the pot has for its truth clay. In fact, there's no real distinction, but there's a distinction. There's no meaningful distinction that you don't have a pot over here and clay over here. In fact, the truth is you only have clay. But pot is there. So like that, the truth is you only have the kshatrajna. That's the only reality. But all of this is here. It has to be accounted for. You have to see it as a clay pot. There's really nothing here except conscious being in terms of substance, what actually is. You know, like if you take any nama rupa, any name form, and you try to find out what is the substance is never going to be the nama rupa. It's going to be what is the content of the nama rupa, what is actually there. So that in any nama rupa, in any object, satya mitya, right? The mitya is the rupa, is the form. The satyam is the content. It's just that any satyam mitya, you take any object in the creation, and its content is also smaller forms which have the same satyam mitya relationship with its content. And so in the end, any form that you experience in the creation, to get to what is actually there, you have to take off the form. If you take off the form, you can't see what's there. The content is non-objectifiable. You are the content. Consciousness is the content. So this satya-mitya relationship takes time to be with. And so here, when he says, let me tell you briefly, you know, he said, we're going to just talk briefly now for a little while. Remember that from 13 to 18, this whole section, is on this identity. We're going to be talking for six chapters on this satyam mitya, on this identity. But now he's just going to say very, very briefly, you know, what this is. So we'll do it next time.
Can't you do it briefly?
I'll do it briefly next time. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
Talking about Satyamitya,
yeah.
I heard you say that it doesn't touch it, and I think that that means that Mityam doesn't touch Satyam.
Yeah, and what I mean by that, that can be misleading as though Mitya's out over here and trying to reach Satyam. I don't mean that. It's that just like if you have an imagination, if I ask you to imagine a meadow, the imagination has no distance from conscious being. It's not separate from it, but it has no power to change it or touch it. It can't make it wet. It can't make it dry. It can't cut it. It can't touch it, and it can't do anything to it. But it has nothing to do with distance. It's just, in a sense, a different order of reality. So it doesn't have the ability to change you. You know, and that's why, you know, you can have any type of thought, any type of perception. Those perceptions come and go without touching you at all, in the sense of changing you or modifying you in any way. That's what I mean by touching.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question about meditation?
Yeah.
Could you mention what Swami you said? The space between the thoughts.
Yeah.
So
even though that's a thought too, but what the mind is always has one thought after another, but usually what he means is that usually the thoughts are objectifying something, but sometimes they're just checking in. They're just kind of diving into your own being, you know? And so that's not an objectified thought. So your mind gets used to, it's like it's always coming home. It always is home, but from its own standpoint, it's active. It's doing this and it's doing that. It's thinking about this, thinking about that. But it gets used to just resting, just kind of taking a dip into your own being, which is always there. You don't need to take a dip into anything. You are always there. But the mind is busy with this and that. You know, but it's just like breathing can just rest in you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, when one is meditating, does one make an effort to get to that place or just let things be? And I mean,
it's effort, but not stressful. It's not a stressful effort. It's effort in only in the sense of direction. Like, if you can relax your body and mind and bring in that kind of inner friend so that the mind isn't having stress or worry. It's just allowed to be as it is. Okay. So you remove that stress. And when that stress is removed, one thing that happens is that your own presence is much more discernible. You can differentiate just your own presence because the mind isn't creating stress for itself. So it's relaxed and allowed to be. And then with that relaxed mind where you're not trying to say, oh, you can't think this and you can't do that, you don't worry about that. You just bring it home. Just let it get used to it's doing what it's doing. You just bring it home. Bring it home. Bring it home. So it gets used to just being, doing what it's doing and just continually coming home. What happens is it starts to, I would say, probably be coming home so fast that you don't, it's as though it's always home. That's, you know, it's because you're always there. Now, one confusion I don't want to happen here is that from your standpoint, just your own self experience, you already are home. You don't need the mind to come home for you to be home. You are the home. You are the home. And you are your own experience. That is not coming and going, and you don't need your mind to come home for you to be. You always are. You're timeless. There's no covering of you. But the mind can get very busy and very engaged, you know? And if you get used to, the mind gets used to just taking a dip instead of, you know, getting lost out here and doing this and that and so tired. And it just gets used to checking in. And at the same time, you don't need to check in with anything because you are you. Does that make sense? So it's like there's two things happening. There's your own stable presence, which is you in its own light. It's like the sun doesn't need anybody to check in with it to be the sun. And I don't need anybody to check in with me or my mind to be this way or that way for me to be me. I'm always exactly the same, no matter what my mind's doing. And that is self-evident. But at the same time, the mind likes to be with me. You know, it would rather be with me. And so whenever it has any free moment, it's just with me. It likes to be home. It likes to stay home. That's
When you say the mind in this context, are you referring to the manas and the buddhi together and not the citta?
I'm referring to the whole mind.
The whole thing. Okay.
Yeah, the whole thing. Like the manas actually, when we talk about manas, if we're talking about the emotional mind or where the complexes are and whatnot, that's one level of manas we can talk about. That manas becomes held and really healed by the buddhi. The buddhi is the one that has self-knowledge, but also self-knowledge and how to be in relationship to the mind and to the world. That's all part of self-knowledge. And so the buddhi, for initially, the manas becomes held by the natural ongoing friendship and support of the buddhi. The buddhi no longer rejects it. It knows how to be with it. It's a good parent. It knows how to be with the mind in a way that with an attitude that will allow the mind to heal and to grow and to get over its complexes and its bad habits and all of that that take time. So the buddhi, because the buddhi has knowledge before the menaces, there's a kind of an emotional lag time. So the buddhi becomes a great supporter, a great friend, you know, or teacher, or parent to the manas. After some time, or whatever you want to say, the buddhi enjoys the self, the very swarupa of the self. So the friendliness of the buddhi is the very nature of the self. Okay. And so there comes a time when it's the self, that it's yourself that is holding the buddhi and the manas and everything. It's like the buddhi doesn't even have to talk to the manas because the manas is being already held by the self, which is the very self of the buddhi. So words are no longer necessary, you know. And sometimes words are necessary. Well, say if there's a big, the mind is tumultuous, or there's a big complex or something that is causing a lot of the pain, a lot of pain in the mind or the unconscious, the buddhi can use words. It can talk to the manas, you know, it can talk to the unconscious, with it enjoying the ananda or the wholeness of the self. Because the buddhi has knowledge. The manas is tumultuous stuff that needs to be worked through. So the buddhi, which has knowledge and enjoys the self, can hold the manas, which is in pain or is in conflict. And it can also use words to talk to it, inner child work and all of that kind of stuff, which is very, very helpful. So sometimes the words of the buddhi help. But there comes a time as the manas and some of these complexes, if they're there, they need talking to often. But when they're not up, then the mind is just in enjoying your own presence. You know, it's just like say to say you're sitting with somebody, you're sitting with somebody who loves you. Just two people. You're sitting in the presence of somebody who loves you. Talking is not necessary. The presence itself is what you're basking in, you know? But then were something to happen, and then that one, and you were to become upset for some reason, then the one who is with you, who loves you, can talk to you in a way that's helpful. But if nothing's wrong, talking isn't, there's nothing to talk about. Your presence itself is the is what is healing. And so that's a fact of it. In fact, the presence of your own being is healing in and of itself. Right? But if the manas, some parts, some complexes, or a little child inside is upset, then the buddhi can talk. Or it need not talk. Depending on what's required. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if this is a play on words, but when you said the I notion gets objectified.
Yeah.
But then this particular verse goes like, then Bhagavan says, and I am in all beings.
Yes, but then
the Bhagavan's I.
Yes, but
I
that's
mean, this is a silly question.
No, but
about Bhagavan's I, is that being
no.
objectified?
But Bhagavan won't have an I thought like an ahankara, but there will be an I sense. Like, for instance, what I mean by that: say, you have, I ask you to think of a meadow. Any thought. You don't have to think, I am thinking of the meadow, in order to have your it to be your meadow thought. You are there. You are the meadow now. So the whole creation has that I, it's called abhimana. Just like every thought that you have is your thought, is pervaded by you. The whole creation is pervaded by the Atma, by Ishvara, by the Atma, by the Self. So the whole creation is a conscious being because itself, the self of the creation, like clay pot, is conscious being. So that's why this creation, the whole creation is known, like your thought is known. See what I mean? But Ishvara doesn't have to say, I am knowing the creation. Like you as a jiva will have an ahankara thought. Mm. Bhagavan won't have an ahankara thought, but the same thing is there without the ahankara thought. Like if you have a thought, and then you say, oh, I know the thought. Yeah. But the thought, you don't need to say, I know the thought. You know the thought. It doesn't require that commentary. So for Ishvara, that commentary is not necessary. That would be messy. Going to, so some vritti flying to the whole thing.
The bathroom is working, by the way.
What is wrong with it?
And how does that differ? How does that differ from our...
No, it was just...
It wasn't me, did
it? It wasn't you, Ed.
It wasn't about the bathroom.
We went from bathroom to your thought. Okay, what were you saying?
And how does that differ? Ishvara doesn't make a commentary that I know all of this. And
because infinite knowledge is there. There's nothing unknown.
And how does that vary from us?
For one thing, you have vrittis. What within this infinite manifestation, you have individual vrittis. And then with each vritti, there's an identification of, because of ajnanam, there's an identification of yourself with the vritti. Like, for instance, if I say, I know the painting, now the pratyagatma, myself, has become a knower of the painting that has sense organs and eyes. But actually, I, from my own standpoint, am not knowing anything. And so any words like, I am knowing this, I am thinking that, that's all happening within the maya, within on an upadhi level, right? It's also true, like, say, for instance, this painting, Through my sense organs, I am have a thought modification of the painting which is illumined by awareness. And so, therefore, because of that, the painting is known. Right? But then I say, I know the painting. Well, who is the I that knows the painting? Is it consciousness that knows the painting? Consciousness is just consciousness.
Mind.
Is the mind performing an act of knowing the painting? Actually, all that's happening is the painting is known. That's what's happening. Because there's a vritti, the sattva, in the sattva, rajas, and tamas of the whole maya, whatever is sattva reflects consciousness as though. So any vritti, whatever is the content of the vritti, is known. And so that's why we say, I know the painting. But actually, because there's a vritti of the painting is known. And if you analyze all of your experience from the farthest out you can go to the innermost, the experience is known. Known is the constant. Known is a synonym. It's just a word for consciousness that is used in relationship to something that's being objectified. So actually there's painting consciousness, space consciousness, body consciousness, sense organs consciousness, thought consciousness, emotion consciousness, consciousness. See, that's why if you say like this, the painting is known, the space is known, the body is known, my sense organs are known, my thoughts are known, I am known, there is just known. There's nothing behind known. Known is consciousness. Consciousness is being. There's nothing but consciousness. What confuses everybody is we always think of consciousness as a knower, but you actually, for consciousness to be a knower, or a thinker, or a feeler, or an enjoyer, you need the upadhi for that. And so those things are all there, but they're there on an upadhi level, not on the level of me. With this viveka, you can differentiate right now that you, in fact, you're being the me, this very personal me. You're not doing anything. You are, you simply are, and you're always exactly the same. And all of this activity is taking place. Now, from the standpoint, I can say, you know, with my mind, I'm thinking. With my sense organs, I'm seeing. You know, with my body, I'm moving. So in all of the body, the mind, the sense organs, all of them enjoy consciousness because all of them are consciousness. Right? But the thing is that there's that different order, that satyamitya, that different order of reality, where the conscious being is the conscious being in which this whole, which is the self of the whole universe, not just of this body, mind, sense organs. And that you can recognize by just being alert to your experience as it's being unfolded to you.
That leap in the verse, recognizing that the self of you is the self of all beings, it feels like a problem for me because even the way you say it, like it's the very personal me, it's the self that you are, like a shortcut that I use sometimes is the self that I am since childhood, like that thing that has never changed.
Right.
But that is so personal that it's
so personal, that's what's such a shock, is to realize that that very personal me is Ishvara, is Brahman, is me. It is absolutely personal. That's the nature of reality. I know, that's it. That's the whole thing. It's just so shocking.
Yeah. Can one say that, you know, that the before knowledge, it's like the Buddha thinks that self-awareness is its.
Yes.
It is self-aware. But in fact, the self-awareness is the self.
Is Brahman, that's right.
Is Brahman.
Yes.
It's not the Buddha's at all. But the Buddha thinks I'm the one that's self-aware.
That's right.
Some sense.
And it isn't.
So that's what makes it connected with the ahankara.
Yeah, the ahankara is really part of the buddhi. It's a type of thought. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. The self-aware...
When it realizes then that actually the self-awareness is not doesn't belong to it at all, and in fact it is even reflected in this...
Yes, that's what we mean by svatta siddha. It's self-evident. Mm-hmm. It's self-luminous. It doesn't require the buddhi, it doesn't require the mind, it doesn't require the creation for it to be self-aware. And when you say self-aware, you have to understand that there's no subject-object relationship there. It's just self-aware because it is awareness.
But somehow, like, it's like the Buddha takes possession of that.
It does. Yeah. So. That's right.
Is that the mutual superimposition?
Well, the Buddha taking possession? There's like this self-awareness that does not involve any type of action or any type of duality. And then the Buddha, you know, which enjoys it, said, then the Buddha says, I am self-aware. I'm a self-aware being. You know, but if you got rid of the Buddha, the self-aware being is there, independent of the Buddha.
So the Buddha...
But would you call that process mutual superimposition? Is that what that refers to?
It's not a process.
Oh, okay.
The mutual superimposition is where the Buddha, which is a thinking entity that has knowledge and clarity, you know, and has the ahankara, I am doing this, I am doing that, and it's the one also that objectifies the manas naturally, that speaks to the manas, can say, you know, I am upset, or all of these, and is descriptive. That Buddha says, I am the conscious being. You know? And then it takes itself to be, then it takes the conscious being to be a knower instead of just self-luminous. So conscious being becomes a knower, becomes the Buddha from the standpoint of the Buddha, and the Buddha becomes the conscious being. Now if you think, when you're saying self-aware, if you mean that the Buddha's commentary, that's not it. The Buddha's commentary belongs to the Buddha. That's Dvaita, right? It's talking about it. Mm-hmm. But the self-awareness is the words we use for self-luminous, self-evident. It doesn't require another pramana, another means of knowledge to illuminate. We use an example for that, like the sun. You don't need to bring in another sun to light up the sun. The sun is its own luminosity. It doesn't need another sun to light it up. The consciousness doesn't need anything to come in and make it aware of itself.
Not even the Buddha.
No. The Buddha...
But the Buddha becomes like a bridge.
Well, now, in terms of gaining self-knowledge, that's different. Mm-hmm. But really, in the gaining of self-knowledge, the Buddha is able to differentiate itself from what is self-luminous. Mm-hmm. It realizes that itself is illumined, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it has viveka.
So it's not the source of luminosity.
It recognizes that it functions, the Buddha is very valuable within the creation. You know, to have a Buddha, functioning Buddha, we want that.
It's just differentiating. Basically.
But that it has to perform that differentiation. And it realizes what it is, and it differentiates its mityatva from the self-evident being, you know, which it totally enjoys, but which never changes. So you can even do exercises using your buddhi. Notice that whatever it's thinking, whatever it's saying, whatever it's philosophizing about, whatever it's noticing, is not changing you at all. It recognizes, but in its recognition, in its ignorance, and in its recognition, absolutely nothing happens to you. You don't become better or less, you know? You don't change at all. Conscious, self-evident you, are illumining the Buddha when it is ignorant as much as you're illumining it when it has knowledge. And when it has knowledge, the Buddha will say, I've always been free, recognizing I'm talking about myself. I've always been here, I've always been exactly the same, and I've always been free. The problem, the viveka, wasn't there. So the mind had superimposed all of its qualities upon the self, and then taken the self to belong to it. Right? So the mind became the conscious being, and the self became moody, or whatever.
The thing is that sometimes it seems like the Buddha, it sort of gets tied up, it ties itself in knots. Like, even in the process of trying to do Drisha Viveka, it can sometimes seem like the Buddha is trying to get behind itself somehow. You know?
It can try, but it can't get
behind. Which you can't do.
You can't do.
Until it finally realizes that what it's trying to get behind
is the self.
Is the self, which is already there and has always been there.
And you can't get behind.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't get behind the self.
Right.
And the buddhi can't get behind itself either. It has to realize, the buddhi has to realize that itself is the self. That's right. The sentence.
It's self-aware quality. What makes it aware is the self.
Actually. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, like the pot has to recognize it's clay, but clay is different than the pot. And that the pot can be broken and the clay can't. You know, the pot can change, totally lose its form. The pot can be made into a plate and now there is no pot anymore. It's gone. If you take the pot and you make it to a plate, there is no pot. The pot's gone. Completely. But nothing's happened to the clay. The clay has nothing to do with the nama-rupa. Right?
So when you said that the citta-nya has a capacity for maya, I think that's what you said.
I said that the citta-nya, the conscious being, has maya. You know, has maya, which is mitya. There's no other place for maya.
So it's a mitya, so it's basically...
It's like a mitya attribute. You can say maya is a mitya attribute of the self. And when you say, you have to say mitya though. Because once you say mitya, it has no being at all, really, apart from consciousness.
That's its prabhava?
That, when we say prabhava, that means like it's shakti. Or
the maya shakti.
The maya shakti. Yeah, which belongs to the upadi, not to Brahman. Yeah.
Seems to me like the idea that myself is the self of all beings is terribly inconvenient, because if that's the case, then this body is of no more importance to me than any other body, and so you have almost a responsibility to take care of everybody else's bodies and emotions, and like your... It just seems like it spreads your sense of self out to the point where it's impossible to care.
Where do you draw the line?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's a nice thing. The thing is, I think more realistically what happens is that you recognize all of this as Ishvara. And this whole creation is a conscious being. And Ishvara Ishvara's responsibility. In a sense, you can't go out and be responsible for all beings. You're only responsible, and all of us, with or without knowledge, dharmically, we have a responsibility for whatever is in our sphere. You know, to whatever degree we have responsibility. Like you have responsibility to your sphere. You can't go and say, "Well, gosh, there's a neighbor over there." You know what I mean? So, yeah, it doesn't become strange like that. I think the thing is that you do recognize, and your sense of self doesn't change in terms of the upadi. I mean, I don't feel that I'm the rug. I feel I'm this body because of the sense of touch. It doesn't change in that way, you know. But what you do recognize is that I know you very well because I know exactly who you are, because your being is my being. Mm-hmm. So there's not somebody else there, you know. And also, the relationship of your mind to your being is the same as the relationship of my mind to my being. And the ajnanam that is there, if there's ajnanam, you understand all of the dynamics, because it's all the same dynamics.
But they don't understand that about you.
Not unless they have knowledge. They won't know that who you really are. But a jnani knows. And in a way, what makes that so nice is just as you are always the same, whoever you're with is always the same too, but the mind can go through all kinds of trips. But it will always come back to you. Even if you're an ajnani, your mind gets... Jnani or ajnani, your mind gets upset or this or that happens and it goes on this painful trip or explosion or whatever's going on. But it will always come back. It can't stay that way, you know. And so for jnanis, you just wait for the person to come back. Their mind has gone in something. They will always come back. And they will come back to to who they are, which is you, so you know what's going on. So that's a nice thing. You give a lot of space to people because you give a lot of space to yourself. Mm-hmm. You know what's going on. That makes sense.
And you don't believe in the story anymore that your mind has generated decades.
That was almost like a Mahavakya.
Well, there is a Mahavakya in that when I recognize that I am you, that's a Mahavakya. Because I can't be you. I can't be you if my being is truly this upadhi. Mm-hmm. Then we're different. You know, different at our very core, then. But that's not the case, and I think we all intuit that anyway. But we don't know it until we know. You know, and also your whole relationship with the creation changes as you recognize this as Ishvara. And recognizing this as Ishvara, you have to remember that Ishvara is yourself, the conscious being. This whole Maya Upadhi. It's not some other being. It's not a manifestation of another being. It's a manifestation of the kshetranya, of the conscious being, which is you. It's like if you say, the dream, I'm only the character in this dream. This dream came from somewhere else. Well, that isn't true. The dream came from you, and all of the characters in it are from you. The whole scenario is from you. Right? And you happen to be identified with one character in it. But the dream isn't foreign to you. It's an expression of your being. This whole creation is an expression of your being, of conscious being, of the me. And so then, you say, okay, this whole creation, the whole of it, is my Maya. The Maya of myself. And so say if you say this is the creation, like Swamiji will call it, it's infinite knowledge. This creation is infinite knowledge. Now what if you say, okay, this creation is my infinite knowledge. Now you start weighing the very finite, limited knowledge of this jiva upadhi to the infinite knowledge of the creation. Or the finite knowledge, just bring it down to size a little bit, the finite knowledge of this jiva to the knowledge of the prarabdha karma means the sphere that you find yourself in. The prarabdha karma is the karma that has caused you to take this body and will take you all the way through to your death. So here is this body, mind, sense organs living within the prarabdha karma, which is my sphere from birth to death. And so I tend to give, I'm very interested in the prarabdha karma. I have a lot of trust in the prarabdha karma over my own judgment. In other words, I look at the whole unfoldment of the life, and not necessarily just my likes and dislikes in terms of what I value or what I'm learning from. I take the prarabdha karma seriously. You know? Like if you think, what's best for me? What is best for me? You know? You know? I want it to be this way because I know what is best for me and I want this. So what is best for me is often just based on your raga dvesha. I don't tend to think that way so much anymore. It's more like, this is what is best for me. This is what is best for me. What is here right now? And so let me deal with it. Let me be with what is here. This is the prarabdha, you know. Instead of trying to have somebody else's prarabdha, their prarabdha is best for me. not this prarabdha.
Mistake.
So that's kind of an acceptance of being determined by the karma, then.
It's more of an enjoyment of living your life, the life that's being given to you. See, there's two ways of thinking about your moment. You live moment to moment to moment to moment to moment to moment. The moment is always here. You're always in a moment. And so you can look at it as, I'm responding to my prarabdha, you know, versus I'm creating my prarabdha. Actually, the moment is already here, and you're responding to it and doing what is to be done. So you can look at life that way, and it's much easier, because the moment is already here, and I'm responding to it, and I'm doing what is to be done. And then I enjoy the unfoldment of my prarabdha. That's one way to live life, you know. To respond to what is taking place and participating in it, in what is actually taking place. Another way is to, which I don't consider a very good way, but is to, you know, try to make the life happen.
Oh, I have to create myself.
Yeah, to create the life. It's hard to be with your life when you're having to create your life. And I'm saying, actually, it's subtle, but in a way, it's both the same, but attitudinally, it's very different. One, you're participating in the life that is here. And it's not that you're trying to make it worse or being lazy. It's not about that at all. It's about actually participating. Fully participating in the life that is here, with the people that are here, with the responsibilities that are here, with the things that are being asked of you, you know, to do. Or even that are being asked by yourself to do. They said that prarabdha manifests in three ways. One is swecha, swaicha. It means your own desires that come up, that push you into that draw you into a situation. The other one is anyecha, anya, icha. Icha means desire. So another's desire will draw you into it. Another is anicha. Nobody's desire, it's just what's manifesting in the creation. So all of these things are drawing you into a given moment, you know, are making you act in a given moment. And so in a way, you're responding to these things, you know, as a mumukshu or as a jnani, you respond to it, kind of appreciating Ishwara, appreciating Dharma, you know, doing what's asked of you in the situation. Enjoying with that Ishwara Arpana Buddhi, that's for the mumukshu. We see everything, this upadhi is playing its part. And so it's nice. You watch how your life unfolds. But that's understanding that you have a life that is unfolding, not that you're a poor stranded creature in this inert creation that has to kind of slog your way through life and do the best you can without any help, where Jnani just sees the whole life as your life is a little piece of Ishwara that is unfolding in the bigger scheme. And then it's much more about responding and being present and enjoying your own the stability of your own being. In the end, you just see everything as Ishwara. But it's not like all of a sudden you see everything as Ishwara and so you just roll up and die. That's very alive. You know?
It's kind of precious because you live with that awareness also, right?
Yeah.
I mean, just to live in that awareness, that's the whole point, right?
Yeah, and recognizing, I mean, the other thing is that your being is the ananda that you seek. For an ajnani, you're running out after the world to fulfill your desires so that you can have these little sukhavrittis, so that you can have a moment of happiness. Whenever you fulfill a desire, you have a moment of happiness. You know, but then the next desire comes and that goes away, or the next threat to that moment, that fulfilled desire. And so that in ajnanam, you're running around trying to produce sukha-vrittis and produce situations that will allow for your mind to relax and all of these things. And for jnani, that goes away because the sukha-vritti is always there as your own presence. You're not running after sukha-vrittis anymore. The mind is enjoying your own presence. That's why I said like breathing, you know, the mind is just enjoying the really the source of ananda and then living this life. Recognizing that this body, mind, sense organs has a prarabdha, and that prarabdha is yours. Nobody can take it away. It's no competition. That's why Swamiji said, you know, if it's yours, you know, if that's in your prarabdha, it's yours. Don't worry about it. If it's not in your prarabdha, it's not yours. Don't forget about it. The prarabdha, you know, no one can do anything with that. You're not even you. Your attitude will make it better or worse in terms of your own sukha-dukkha. But the prarabdha, you know, the general flow of your life is there for you to have. It's your life. You know, so you don't have to worry. But our problem is I want that life, not this one. That's because the sukha, the ananda, is projected out onto the world. And it's usually projected somewhere else. If it's going to be projected, it's not going to be here, right? You project it somewhere else, and then that becomes very frustrating because it's projected away from you. If it's not being projected, then right here is fine. Because if you're projecting it, then your mind tenses up because the ananda that you're seeking is over there to be achieved. If you're not projecting, then your mind is fine the way it is. And if your mind is fine the way it is, then the situation is fine the way it is. I'm starting to feel blabby. Hi, Carl. Hi, John. Hi, Nella. Hi, Nettie. Vivian. Hi, Ditchin.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So our conditioning.